Hej och välkomna till ett nytt avsnitt av podden Ortodox kristen tro. Idag har jag med mig en gäst och jag kommer att börja prata engelska med honom alldeles efter den här introduktionen. Podden Ortodox kristen tro sker som ett av vår församlings verksamheter. Det är Kristi uppståndelses ortodoxa församling i Göteborg. Och om du vill stötta den församlingen och den här podden så kan du swisha en gåva på 123-278-8099. Församlingen hittar du på www.kristiuppstandelse.se. Den här podden sponsras också av bokförlaget Artos. Artos ger ut mycket bra kristen litteratur från den tidiga kyrkan. Och vi ska prata om manlighet idag med min gäst. Och då tog jag ett exempel på en människa som förverkligade ett manligt liv kan man säga. Nämligen den helige Antonius den store. Och boken Antonius liv av Athanasius den store, biskopen i Alexandria, finns utgiven på Artos bokförlag. Så här ser min utgåva ut. Och det är mycket läsvärt, en urkyrklig bestseller. Du hittar den på www.artos.se. Och nu till min gäst, Paul Lloyd Robson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Father Michael. It's an honor to be here.
Even though we speak English, you are actually living in Denmark, so that's quite close by. Paul, can you please tell us a little about who you are? Just a short introduction.
Yeah. So I'm an Orthodox Christian. I'm born and raised in South Africa, but I've been in Denmark for 20 years. I have mixed British and Dutch descent. And I'm living on a little homestead out in the Danish countryside. And I've been working for the last 8 or 9 years supporting men, mainly writing. I actually started something called the European Men's Gathering, which started up in Sweden and has always had a very large contingent of Swedes attending and joining. Seems to be there's something about men and masculinity in Sweden as well as in Denmark. Today I run a network of online mastermind groups, and I have groups of men coming out to our little homestead farm here in the Danish countryside regularly.
Are you able to host at your homestead, your farm, or are you able to host many people there?
Yeah, we've been incredibly blessed to have a beautiful place here with a lot of space. And so we've had, so far, I think the biggest group has been about 35 guys here. Before, I've had groups of about 140 men at other rented venues before I bought this place. So in time, we might have larger groups here. But right now, I'm actually focusing on, I found like there's a really nice group size of about like 6 to 10 guys or something like that. That's really good to work with.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
You're married and you have a family?
Yeah, I am married in an Orthodox marriage. My wife is also Orthodox. And I have 3 sons. One is 4 months old. One is just turned 3 years old. And then I have a 17-year-old as well.
Oh, so a little gap there.
Yeah, quite a gap, yeah.
Wonderful. And the Orthodox Church in Denmark, just really short for our listeners, how many, are there many churches around there, and which ones are represented?
Yeah, it's not a very large community, especially amongst ethnic Danes. There are not a lot of Orthodox people, but certainly growing. And there's a movement of young men, especially, that are coming into the Orthodox Church. In some ways, I think, reflecting the journey that I've taken myself, it seems to be a global phenomenon. I know this is happening in many countries at the moment as well. But yeah, we have a lot of Romanians. Romanians are everywhere. There's like piles and piles of everywhere you go, there's a Romanian church with groups, big families of Romanians that are attending their churches. Very close to me, there's a tiny little Orthodox monastery with a single Russian nun living out on an island. Oh. And there's a very well-known, actually award-winning documentary about how that happened. It's very, very fascinating to find out Mother Amposia and how she came to Denmark and establishes a, it's a massive blessing for me and my family. That's where we attend as much as we possibly can.
Wonderful.
Just about a 25-minute boat ride away from where we live. And then there are both Russian, Ukrainian, Serbian churches dotted around the country, especially in the big cities, of course.
Right.
But not massive amounts of ethnic Danes at the moment.
Right. Right. The Greek community, there's nothing.
There's at least one Greek church I know of. One Greek church I know of in Roskilde, and then also. Only one, but not. I've never attended a Greek church.
No. This phenomenon with men, young men joining the church, that is something that I've spoken with my wife and several friends about for many years. I think 10 years at least. But as you say, I think this phenomenon has been more intensified in the last 3 years, perhaps, something like that. I will talk more about that in a bit, but and we're also going to talk about your work with the podcast As Iron Sharpens Iron on Ancient Faith Radio, which you do together with Father Hans Jakobse and Father Michael Butler. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce Father Hans' last name.
That was very, very, very good. Yeah,
Jakobse. Where is he from?
He lives in Florida, but he has Dutch descent. Dutch. So actually, we have a little bit of a connection there because it's very close to the Afrikaner kind of Dutch Reformed roots, which he also grew up in. So
right, we're going to talk about that. But first, I want to talk a little bit about your own journey. As I understand it, you haven't been Orthodox all your life. Would you like to tell us a little bit about your journey to Orthodoxy, where you came from? Spiritually, culturally, and what got you interested into the Orthodox Church, and how and where you were finally received into the body of Christ?
Yeah, I'll try to keep it short because it's quite a story. So as I said, I grew up in an Orthodox church. My father is what he would call a minister in that church. It was a very kind of participant orientated church in a Pentecostal tradition, but like old school Pentecostal. So not like the Pentecostal churches you'll find in Sweden and the free churches in Scandinavia, I think, which are kind of much more kind of, you know, rock bands and stuff like that. This was far more conservative than that. This church was actually founded by my grandfather, who was a very, very charismatic man. He was a very well-known South African personality. And so I grew up going to church 5 times a week my entire childhood. And very, very engaged in Christianity. I would go out in like evangelizing other kids in my school class, disputing different theological things with other boys in my class and stuff like that. Not always appreciated equally by all of my school colleagues, but I was in the debating society, so I could, like, you know, this thing of like being able to argue my case in a very cognitive way was something that I definitely had. As I kind of grew up and became a teenager, I think I also became less and less, you know, I was more pulled into and, you know, kind of not as strong Christian kind of foundation in my life as I grew up. And I left South Africa already at the age of 18 to go out and discover the world. I moved to the UK. I got a working holiday visa there and ended up on a whole lot of travels, met a Danish woman in Egypt, of all places, where I lived for 9 months. This Danish woman came to South Africa, and I kind of remember a time when I really stood at a crossroads and decided that, this whole like Europe and Denmark and Scandinavia was so much more exciting and interesting and modern, and all this kind of archaic South African stuff was less interesting. And the Christianity also of my childhood, I kind of put that aside. And so I married this woman, moved to Denmark, and quite quickly actually dropped my Christian faith and started calling myself an atheist. And even went around telling Christians that I met why, you know, religion was the source of all evil in the world, and would kind of, you know, I'd be very anti-Christian for a long time. And so I lived a very secular life. I went to university, took a study, was educated as a political scientist at Copenhagen University, had a career, worked for Microsoft for 8 years, was down in Brussels and all over the place, traveling around, living, reaching all the goals that I thought were going to make me happy. But from the inside out, my life slowly actually started disintegrating and falling to pieces. I say I entered into, you know, what you could call a meaning crisis or something like that. And then especially what happened is my marriage fell apart. And large cracks showed up there. And so that kind of initiated me into a spiritual search at that time. So that I was probably around 30 years old when that happened. And so the spiritual search was, of course, first of all, everything but Christianity. Because Christianity, I tried that. I'd seen it was just a bunch of old superstition and rubbish. So I didn't need that. So, of course, I looked more to the East and to also, you know, all kinds of strange and weird and wonderful New Age philosophies and things like that. I won't go into the detail. Maybe that can be a subject for another podcast. But slowly but surely through that journey, I believe there was an honest search going on there. And so where it was possible, then Christ entered into my life in small little steps.
Through your search, would you say it was through your search in the Eastern religions or New Age, were Christ able to reveal himself, so to speak?
Yeah, I would say so. So, I mean, all of these philosophies and systems of thought and beliefs, they have elements of truth in them. So, so there was things that kind of, you know, one of the most deceptive religions that we practice today is the secular religion, right? It is a religion in many ways. And so breaking out of that gave me a lot of life energy, a lot of inspiration. It brought me back to life in some ways. And it was bringing me back to God, even though the name of Christ Jesus was still a barrier for me, right? It was still a stumbling block for me.
Yeah.
So God revealed things to me that I was able to receive. And slowly but surely, then even the name of Christ. Actually, I was on a little retreat on an island in Thailand where there was this Swami who started on Easter Day, he started talking about Jesus Christ. And I was incredibly confused by that. It was really strange for me that, you know, this kind of, you know, Swami would talk about this thing from my past that I had kind of written off. And so that was like a first light for me that kind of realized like, oh, there is something. And then I think a really big thing for me that happened was Jordan Peterson kind of came onto the scene there in 2017, 2016. I started listening a bit to him and he said this thing. He spoke about the Bible and he said, you know, this book, it's older than our civilization. Some of the stories of it are, you know, far, far older. Everything that we have built our society on is based on this book. And so one thing we can't do is just write it off. You know, you have to at the very least, you have to contend with the ideas in there. You have to wrestle with them. When he said that, I was like, oh my gosh, he's right. I've been writing this off and not appreciating it for the value that it has. And as a result, I'm living in a kind of childish rebellion because I haven't been actually taking it seriously enough. I've just been thinking, oh no, that's passé. It doesn't matter or something like that. And so that was a long journey that led me to, in 2018, I had a very, very real experience of God that happened down in South Africa, where suddenly the reality of God became incredibly clear. And it wasn't the God that I had kind of written off as an atheist. That wasn't the God that was the God of Christianity. I'd written off a kind of materialist, you know, sky daddy God or something like that. And that was obviously not the God of the Orthodox Church. And so I had this experience of like, wow, there's a God that is in, you know, that is present in all things and fills all things, right? And so I, as you prayed when we started, before we started this interview, and so I started searching for a church where I could find that God. And so that was a long search. It took me quite a long time. The first time I walked into an Orthodox church, it was very coincidental that it happened. The priest there, Father Lazarus, he said, welcome, you've just found the best kept secret of Christianity. and it's very much the case that it has been the best kept secret. But from that very first time, I knew that I'd found something incredibly special. And the deeper that I dug, the more it was clear to me that the Orthodox Church was that original faith directly inherited from the apostles, from Christ. And every single way that I approached the questions that I had and dug into these, like, how can I find my spiritual home? The more that I found that this is where I wanted to be. This was my home, you know, and that was from the very kind of, you know, intellectually skeptical academic studies that I was digging into the historical evidence and stuff like that, but also over to, you know, the embodied spiritual practices that I was engaging in. Everything just confirmed for me that I found
place. Wonderful. So, wonderful. Yeah. But you said you hadn't taken the God of your upbringing seriously, or your faith seriously. At the same time, you said that you were in church 5 days a week and you were trying to engage your friends in conversation about theological matters. Didn't that faith, so to speak, how come that faith did not evolve, would you say?
I don't know. I think our faith does need to constantly evolve, right? Like, yeah. As children, we have childish beliefs and yeah. We should have childish beliefs, and that's okay to have childish beliefs. And I can see how I've received so many gifts from my parents and from my upbringing, from my childhood. Mm. I was marinated in the Bible yes. and the biblical teachings, and it's so good for me. And when I came to Denmark, I was incredibly successful with everything that I did. Why is that? Well, it's because I received so much love and care and consideration from a family that had always put Christ first in every decision that they made. Mm. So even though I'd rejected the name of Christ, then the operating system was still running on the structure of God, on that, yeah. on that basic foundational principles
yeah.
and system and way of being that was based in Christ. And so you know, there's plenty of good left.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Wonderful to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say the same for my own upbringing as well. Especially, I'm a son of a Lutheran priest here in Sweden.
Okay.
And our family we've had the Bible very close to our daily lives, and that is truly a gift to have been marinated in the Bible. It's wonderful. I think, as you said, you have to make your own journey, and when you discover the Orthodox faith, you realize that it's not only something that's up here in the head, in the science of the mind, so to speak, but something that involves your whole being as a person, and that is really attractive to many seekers, I would say, today. And that's exactly what the Orthodox Church has, something that deifies you as a whole person, body and soul. We are going to talk a bit about manliness, and this is a topic in Sweden that is a bit controversial. Some would say that there's no such thing as manliness. They would say there's only persons, and you can be whatever you decide to be. So we have people that are cats, for example. it's a bit extreme. But and then you have on the other extremes, other variants of how you approach this subject. Anyway, it's quite a difficult subject. That's why I wanted to talk to you about it, because it's important to dig into this topic, since God created us as human beings, as male and female, he made them. That's what we read in Genesis. And so before we delve into this topic, let's start at the very positive end. Let's start with, if you could give us three words that would sum up what manliness means from an Orthodox perspective, and if you could also give us your three primary role models for men in the church tradition or in the Bible or where you find them, who would those be? Let's start there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I'll start with the second one because it's easier to answer from an Orthodox perspective.
Yeah, please.
There's something about, you know, human beings are infinitely deep and complex. And so we simplify things in categories sometimes, but a human being can still kind of contain that. So there's something really about that a person being a role model, right? And so, you know, the easy answer, of course, is Christ, to just say, well, Christ is the model of a man and a woman in some ways. On the podcast, then actually, Father Hans made a great point about Mary being the role model for a man and a manliness. Just as Christ was created or born in her womb, then in the same way, we also can have Christ enter into us and be born inside of us and to come out of us as well. So that's a really beautiful answer as well, I think, which I'll have to credit to Father Hans. But if I had to give three concrete role models on a practical level that I use in a very everyday level and that are really inspiring for me right now in my life, then I'm going to have two very recent saints. I think the saints are so ideal to use because they're unique to the Orthodox Church, at least the Orthodox saints are. And they're just such an amazing proof of the power that's found within the church. And we have them so recently. And the one I want to mention, first of all, is St. Paisios. I've read almost everything that's written about him that I'd be able to put my fingers onto. I've had his spiritual counsels on my bedside table for probably 2 years or something like that, reading them every night before I go to sleep. And it's really been great. Now I've moved on to other things as well. But he was a soldier. He was in the military. He was in war situations, life and death situations. And he had such a humility and such a love for his fellow man, for his fellow soldiers, that he has these incredible feats of bravery and strength and fortitude. But none of them come from this kind of like, oh, I'm a strong man kind of thing at all. They come from actually an absolute humility about what he himself is and wanting to give up to other people. And so it's such a clear image of how this Christ-like love of others can lead to what we all appreciate and see as manly strength, actually, in St. Paisios. He's a beautiful example of that in, you know, a very modern day war where we see these situations. You know, just died in 94, 96, I think, something like that.
Yeah, wonderful.
The second one, he's just such a simple man as well. There's none of the high flying, you know, he grew up in a tiny little village, has no real big education or anything like that. Very simple man, yet such powerful words of such directness. So that was incredibly good. The next one is Saint Nectarios. There's a film out about him, Man of God, which I think has been incredibly appreciated. So watch that if you haven't seen it.
Wonderful movie. It's I told my wife when we finished watching it that it's not very often that you come to the end of a movie and you feel spiritually uplifted. But that is such a movie, indeed. Man of God,
yeah, definitely worthwhile watching, yeah. So, and I think, I don't know, for me, there's something about the moment that we're facing in our culture and our society today, which makes his example incredibly valuable to face as well, especially for men.
What ways?
Well, he just had such a humble but powerfully masculine approach of putting his trust in God when it came to being oppressed or wrongfully accused of something, that I think that that's something that we can really take inspiration from. I think that's the core of it, at least.
Great.
And then the last one I want to mention is an Old Testament who I've just since the very early days, an Old Testament figure. It's King David. Who's just such a nuanced character. We have so many varied approaches from his life. Before I came to Christianity, I was very interested in these Jungian archetypes. And there's this book by Gillette and Moore called King Warrior, Magician and Lover. And just like seeing how King David more than overflows these categories of being a king, a warrior, a magician in some ways, and then a lover as well, like the author of the Psalms, you know, and just the image of him like dancing before the Ark of the Covenant as they're entering into the Temple of Jerusalem. There's just so many nuances to the way that he embodied a manly spirit and you know, just the archetypical king in a very, very powerful way as well. And yet a very fallible man as well. And we have this Psalm 50 as an example of repentance from him as well. So yeah, it's very, very powerful.
A fallible man who saw when he was, committed sin and repented that. So that's great. Okay, that's wonderful. So Saint Paisios, Saint Nectarios, and Saint David, from the Old Testament. Great. Those are wonderful, wonderful examples. And let me just pick up on what you said, short notice on the Most Holy Mother of God, the Theotokos. I think it was G.K. Chesterton who said that the best example of a man is a woman, and it's the Theotokos. The best example of how to live as a man is the is a woman, the Theotokos. And I think Callistus, Metropolitan Callistus Ware of blessed memory, said somewhere that we are all called to bear Christ in our lives, not as concrete as she did, though, but still in a sort of spiritual manner. So that's really a good example as well. Okay, Paul, do you also have three words?
Yeah, this was much more difficult. because I really thought about it a lot, and my answer, that the best answer I could come up with, actually, I guess I'm cheating a little bit here, but it's to quote Moses from Genesis, the very first beginning, and that is that man is created in the image and the likeness of God, those three things. And so the Orthodox understanding, as I've understood it, is that the image refers to the spark of divinity that is present in every single person. We're created in this image of God. God is actually the full representative of what a person is, but man is created in that image, and every human being we recognize the infinite value of human life. And that every single person is created in that image. And then the likeness of God refers to this process of theosis, that we can become more and more as we are purified, as we are able to, even to follow the example of the Theotokos, to come closer to God and to be able to experience in this lifetime the more and more of a likeness of God. And then finally, God himself, that is the mystery, that is, there's this depth to the Orthodox faith that I think is so amazing, where God is defined in a cacophatic definition and an apophatic definition as well, where we can only say what God is not as well as we can say what he is as well. But I really like what I was thinking of, just like, well, in some way, in this process of theosis, God is the target of man. Like we aim towards God. That's what we do. We aim towards divinity. But then I've also had the privilege of talking to Archimandrite Zacharias of Essex, the monastery over there, the St. John the Baptist monastery, and he has a book called Man, the Target of God. And so there's this synergistic relationship between man and God as well, where really what, God is wooing us as the bridegroom, really, and we're wanting to be united with him if we answer that call as well. We try to answer that call.
Wonderful, great. I would also add, I noticed a word that kept occurring when you described the three saints, and a distinctive character of all of them was humility. Mm-hmm. Saint Paisios in his humility, of course, in everything that he did. Saint Nectarios being humble, even as he was falsely accused. And Saint David humbling himself when the prophet Nathan, I think, pointed out to him that you are that man, you are that sinner. I think that's really also important to remember when we speak about what manliness from a Christian perspective is. I would say that the key term is being humble. And of course, that's something that's key to every Christian. Every Orthodox Christian needs to seek out humility. But we seek out those virtues in different ways, I think, depending on where we come from. And being a man and a woman is part of how we approach the virtues. And when we look at what St. Paul, how he describes the role of men in marriage in Ephesians chapter 5, it's a sort of humble, very self-sacrificing love that he describes. He describes us, we should love our wives as Christ loves the church, sacrificing himself for her. I don't read the Bible in English primarily, so I'm not sure if I used the...
That was spot on.
So that's wonderful. And your journey, got you into working with men. If you describe your work a little, tell us about Manifesto, and especially tell us about the Orthodox podcast as iron sharpens iron. I think our listeners are most interested in that last one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, what I found, I started working with men before I became a Christian. In my spiritual search, I found that I was, you know, kind of young man, lots of libido. And what I found is that when I addressed the deepest questions of existence, then there was a certain different dynamic when I was just with a group of men to when I was with groups of mixed men and women. I think that in all of human history for tens of thousands of years, however long you want to say, there's been naturally communities of men that have spent a lot of time together. And very recently, since especially starting since the end of the Second World War, then male and female only spaces have been disappearing. And most of the time, and especially if you live in a big city today, this isn't true for all places, but especially people living in a big city, you'll very seldom experience where you're just with one gender, male or female. And not everybody misses this, but a lot of people, and myself included, I think, found that when I suddenly was just with men, there was an ability to be honest and direct and really kind of talk more directly about things, which I found incredibly valuable. I spoke to a researcher, actually a female researcher, who did a big study in the Danish health system, and they asked people, if you do something wrong, if you make a mistake, would you prefer to know get to know it directly, or would you prefer if someone kind of indirectly helps you to see it? And there was such a clear distinction. Every single, like, amongst male respondents, it was like 95% would say, like, I'd prefer if someone just says it to me directly. Whereas for females, 95% said, I'd really prefer it if they kind of indirectly helped me to see it. So it's a massive difference in the way that men and women deal with disagreements, with like different, you know, kind of dealing with conflicts and stuff like that as well. And so as I was engaging the spiritual search, I found a real value there of just being with men. And so what I found is I decided, okay, well, I want to do something to help other men. And to do that, I needed something that was greater than myself. I realized, like, you know, in the beginning, I was like, oh yeah, I've got all the answers. I know how to be a man. I'm a real good man. I'm going to show everybody and tell everybody what to do. Of course, I realized very quickly the folly of that approach, right? Mm-hmm. And so I needed something bigger than myself. And what I really found is that the Orthodox faith has and contains the deepest mysteries of existence. So there's a very clear cosmology, there's a very clear anthropology, and it gives me all of the answers that I need to the extent that I'm able to receive them. So the biggest barrier is really my ability to be able to, it's not just a cognitive understanding, it's something that needs to be lived and experienced through the practices of the church. And so what I found is that these answers are true for all people, for all times. And so even though I still today work probably with a majority of non-Christians, although there's, you know, it's maybe a increasingly, you know, 30-70 split or something like that. Mm-hmm. But even people who hate Christianity, they love the answers that I get from the Christian faith, because it's the truth and they all recognize the truth. You know, Christ is the Logos. He is the incarnation. He is the truth and the way and the life. And so when people hear these things, then they appreciate them as well. And so as I'm able to receive revelation from the scriptures, from the church fathers, from, you know, the divine services of the church, then apply them into my own life, then I can also be able to share them with other people. And so that's what the podcast of As Iron Sharpens Iron is, really just my way of getting to talk to two men who I really admire, Father Hans and Father Michael, and to be able to explore ideas with them and bounce ideas off them, and get to spend time with them as well. We're all going to be meeting up here in October as well, actually, and doing a retreat in Detroit, where we have a whole lot of guys coming, and we're going to be working through these things. So it's just like I get to hang out with guys that are inspirations for me and talked about deep and meaningful things with them as well. And as I do that, then we also run projects together. We try and make things work in the real world. Yeah. And that's another way of like actually taking these ideas and putting them into practice in our lives as well.
Hmm. You're working,
that's what we're doing. Yeah.
You're working Manifesto, that organization. Would you say that it's only on the theoretical level, or is it also applied in the daily lives of the participants of that project in some way? Small groups of men helping each other out locally, for example, in Copenhagen or other places like that?
Yeah, so As Iron Sharpens Iron is very theoretical. We just talk there. It's a podcast. Mm-hmm. But then Manifesto is the opposite end of the spectrum because it's not explicitly Christian. Like, it's built on Christian values, but it's really about living the Christian life. And so basically what we do is that we have a clear kind of approach and method, which is about habits, goals, and vision. And it's a kind of iterative circular process where you formulate a vision of what you want to do in your life based on your best understanding of what reality and life is about. You then set concrete goals that you want to reach, and then you try and address at the habit level. And changing your habits requires also changing your actions, which requires changing your thoughts, which requires changing your practices in your daily life. But and then you're held accountable for your actions by a group of guys over a long period of time. So people who are members of Manifesto, I think on average, people come into Manifesto Core and they stay there for like a year and a half, 2 years on average. And it's normally because they realize like they have some destructive self-sabotaging patterns in their life, and they want to make some changes. And so they come in there and they start trying to align their ideas about themselves and who they are and where they want to go with what they're actually doing on their everyday life. And normally people have a very big gap in those things. That's what we do on Manifesto Core. You're put in a group of guys and you work together with that group to bring alignment to what you say you want to do with yourself and what you're actually doing. And normally it's the first thing that changes more than the second thing, because a lot of the time people have very unrealistic ideas about what they're doing. And this is Christians as well as non-Christians. Mm. We all struggle with this as well. So this thing of accountability, being called out by a group of brothers who are honest with you and direct with you. And we give each other permission to do this as well, you know, to be able to say like, build it. It's really about building integrity. And for me, what it is, I think it's, there's something about this process of accountability. It's built on a lack of understanding of judgment. We live in a society which has kind of like, judgment has become this bad, dirty thing. It's all about being tolerant and accepting and allowing everything in. But as Christians, we believe that there is a judgment. There's a final judgment. And God is very merciful. And we live in a period of incredible grace. Our lives are so full of grace. And we're really living, you know, if you look at what's happening around us today, I'd say the grace of God is greater than ever before. And so what we're doing is, the idea is that if we judge ourselves, instead of judging other people outside of ourselves, then we're able to, you know, be able to bring ourselves into alignment a bit better. And that's something that we can use as loving and supportive brotherhood to be able to do better. Because a lot of the time it's difficult for us to see our own things, right? We rationalize our own actions.
Indeed. Maybe we sometimes carry the opposite of humility as men and go about in pride. You know, I am my own king. I know best for myself. And I agree wholeheartedly with you that we need people to be accountable for. And we have that to some extent also in the church. I mean, when you come to confession, for example, and you let yourself be guided by your spiritual father. And I'm reminded of a saying of, I think, St. Paisios, who said that, be strict with yourself and be lenient with others. This is a very good rule to make yourself sort of the yeast or the sourdough in your community. The you said that 70% are non-Christians, maybe, but you also said that they still agree with the message, which is basically a Christian message that you relate on those meetings. They are open to this, correct?
Yeah. I mean, there's been some really interesting conversations. And there are some people who just don't want to change. The costs are sometimes too high. And so it becomes very clear and apparent when people don't want to change things in their lives. And there's things that are really difficult to change. And so we also need to be careful and gentle with each other as well, because it's really about making a small trajectory change. But truth is light. And when light shines in our lives and we experience it together, then we it's hard to deny it, right? Like we see it and accept it. And then there are people like, light is painful and it hurts and it disinfects, it rinses, but it's in some ways it's like, as men, we need to get used to this idea of dying, of like that is what we're called to do. It says, as Christ, you know, we love our wives as Christ loved the church. Well, what did Christ do? He died for the church. Mm-hmm. And so we as men, we need to, if we get used to the small deaths of our ego on an everyday level, then we become the kind of men who, when it really counts, we're forming our being to be able to say, well, you know, because we all recognize the hero who's able to put his own life aside and be inspired. You know, the first time you watched Braveheart, maybe I'm showing my age here or something like that, but he's like freedom! As he was like getting cut into pieces, right? But the Christian saints as well, which, you know, cause the Roman Empire, the greatest empire that ever existed, to be converted to Christianity, converted to Christ, the man who had put to death, which, you know, Christ lovingly and willingly submitted himself and took over the Christian Empire by doing that as well. So we become the men who can carry that power and that strength of love that has all authority and power in the world onwards into the world, into our family lives, into our communities, into our leadership positions, whatever it is that we're doing.
Wonderful. A quick question. Would you say that there's a crisis in masculinity in the Western society today? Do you agree with that?
I think if you look at mainstream culture is increasingly now becoming detached from the Christian foundation that it's been built on. And so I think as soon as culture removes itself from Christ, there's going to be a crisis because Christ is truth. Christ is the light.
Yeah.
And so for a long time in Western society in Scandinavia, there's been a very just normalized everyday structure of the Christian church has filled up a lot of space and given a lot of structure to us. And so now we're, you know, there's been a process happening, probably started in universities and, you know, specific academical things, and now spread very much in media and politics, where this kind of actually become popular to utterly reject and even criticize these Christian foundations. And so I think there's a crisis of masculinity. There's very much a crisis of femininity as well. I think a lot of what we see of, like, you know, pro-feminist behavior is really the masculinization of women, or the glorification of the masculine ideals of strength and power and domination, just in women instead of in men.
Yeah.
And so it's really a crisis of all of these things as well. I think that is there's some very interesting things happening with men specifically at a physical biological level as well. Right now we're seeing men's testosterone levels falling drastically. Mm-hmm. We know that when men's testosterone levels fall, you know, we're something like between 10 to 30% lower than our grandfathers on average in Scandinavia. It's probably to do with, you know, I'm not going to go into the reasons for it, but there's a lot of, there's not any conclusive scientific studies that show why this is happening,
mm-hmm.
but
a lot of factors, probably.
We know that if you have lower testosterone as a man, you're much more susceptible to all kinds of diseases, to loneliness, anxiety, depression, and it's really bad. And so we see this also an explosion of all kinds of mental illnesses, of loneliness, more single men in Denmark than ever before today. I think probably the same in Sweden as well.
Probably. I haven't seen any numbers, but what you're describing then is this crisis in masculinity is both in a biological sense, what you say with testosterone, for example, and also culturally. The process which you describe is very good, laid out by, for example, authors such as Douglas Murray in his book The War on the West or The Madness of Crowds. So there's definitely something happening there in the culture that is trying to destroy this Christian foundation of the society. Mm-hmm. And the typical Swede, I think, would jump on hearing words such as patriarchy, or even sometimes when hearing, as I alluded to earlier, that there are even differences between the sexes. How would you convince such listeners, if any of those are still around, that on the contrary, focusing on healthy masculinity is desirable for both men and women, and also for society as a whole? Mm-hmm.
Well, I certainly don't try and convince anybody.
That's
like,
a good start.
I found that addressing these things, a lot of these things are driven by, a lot of the time, it's relationship to mom and dad, actually. And the stories that we tell in our society about fatherhood and motherhood. especially about fatherhood these days, are I think a big part of the problem. So I think it's rather just like, as we go further and further down this path, then the problems with this kind of worldview are becoming very apparent. So it comes, it's obviously, it's the most obvious right now, how you see putting men into female sports or men into female prisons, where it's kind of, but in general, just as we're denying these masculine and feminine categories, then we're just seeing more and more twisted and extreme archetypes of masculinity and femininity becoming popular. And so you'll see, like, you know, the real gangster, aggressive man, or the kind of total weakling, pathetic man becoming more and more popular. And the same with women as well. You see, like, the prostitute, you know, absolute slut, sex crazed woman, and, you know, these, or the kind of like dominant masculine female, you know, it's crazy, stupid, twisted archetypes of masculine, feminine, but even more and more extreme in some way. So the more that we're denying these things, the more that their shadows are kind of like growing out. And so I don't think we need to try and convince anybody, but what we do need to do is to be, I think a core thing, and I'm really inspired by Jonathan Peugeot, is about telling stories about the positive examples of this. It's so rare to find stories of good fathers who are building stable homes and families and raising up their communities and investing in the next generation. And so all the stories are kind of trying to do the opposite, right?
Let me just, I agree with you wholeheartedly. Wonderful to tell stories, because that's natural for us to listen to and to remember as well. I remember many years ago, the Orthodox Christian author, Frederica Matthews Green, I think maybe you know of her. Yeah. She's quite famous, but she wrote somewhere that in our popular culture today, and this was maybe 15 years ago, all male role models are portrayed as, you know, fumbling idiots. A father in a family, he's, you know, he doesn't know anything. He's not your typical role model, so to speak. And this is also in other media as well. And I told this to my wife. At first she didn't believe me, but then the more she thought about it, she understood, yes, this is actually true. And we had the occasion to speak with someone else about it the other day. And I think that's something, the story of being what a man is lost to some extent. And people don't realize it because they didn't think about it. But when you open up the eyes to their eyes to it, they will see that, yeah, this is actually true. Maleness is portrayed as a sort of a stupid, a bit not very smart person. So I agree with you wholeheartedly. Tell stories about positive male role models.
And then I think we also need to really understand what's happening, like what's the root of the problem here. And so you use the word patriarchy, so I'm going to talk about that. And yeah, it's a trigger word for a lot of people.
Yes,
it's really interesting to get a group of people in a room and explain to them, what does the word patriarchy actually mean? And then discuss, how do I relate to this? Because of course, patriarchy, it means the rule of the father. It's not an androarchy. Androarchy is the rule of man. So what is the natural role of a father? What does father do? Even according to evolutionary theory, a father should nourish and cherish and love his children, because that's how they will become raised to become strong and able to have a successful and thriving life. Of course, in Christian understanding, then the role of a father is even more central and more emphasis on that loving, cherishing, nourishing part as well, of course, right? So in any understanding of the word fatherhood, then the good father is the loving father, the caring father, the protecting father. And so the fact that we've made patriarchy, the rule of the father, as the source of all evil in society, this is widely recognized and seen as a core principle of our modern secular state and understanding of life, is patriarchy is evil and bad. It's not just the rule of men, which one could make a better case for is based on tyranny and domination or something like that. But the father is the root of it. For me, that's a key to understanding, well, maybe there's something going on here in this word patriarchy. And maybe that we need to take another approach to looking into it. All of feminism states, and I fully agree with, that all of human history has been patriarchal. There's pretty much no examples of matriarchal societies. There's little tiny little examples, but it's very much the, you know, against the grain, the you know, to kind of confirm the rule.
Yeah.
And so as Christians, we believe that God is father. Again, that doesn't mean that God is a man, but what fatherhood is actually a higher thing, and it describes something about our relationship to God, and that God has a fatherly, paternal role for us. We spoke a lot on, and so we've really gone into this subject on the Iron Sharpens Iron podcast, and I think there's a lot of really great explanations from Father Hans and Father Michael about it. Mm-hmm. But there's a particular paternal aspect to the love that we receive from God, which gives structure and meaning, and there's a specifically feminine approach to the way that we meet God, and we were speaking about the Mother Mary of being able to receive and obey.
Yeah, of course.
And that doesn't mean that women should always obey and men should always dominate. It's not at all the case. And you could just come and meet my wife and spend have lunch with us if you want to see how that works out in practice, of course, right? Because we love one another. But I think that we do need to have this really difficult conversation about the word patriarchy to really get to the roots of this problem. If one, I think not everybody needs to do that, but I think that's necessary. Yeah. Hmm.
That's great. Great to make that distinction between patriarchy and andriarchy. Yeah. Those are, I think, often conflated. And I think there's something good. I agree with you that there's something going to be found in the theme of patriarchy. If you approach it from a deeply Christian perspective, and if you yourself are a man or a father that tries to align your own life according to Christ's, this is the basic foundation. Again, I would say that humility is where you need to start from if you're going to approach and discover that more.
I mean, basically our understanding of what anything around leadership and hierarchy has been kind of infected by these pictures of, like, you know, the big fat bank director smoking his cigar with his feet up on the table and, you know, using his power to oppress other people. So we've conflated leadership with tyranny. Hmm. And actually, like Christ showed us, no, leadership is love. That's the only kind of, you know, the only way you can have authority through tyranny is through force. Hmm. And that's the opposite of what patriarchy is about. Patriarchy, it will never work that way. Patriarchy that's based on tyranny will only lead to destruction and disintegration. And that's what we're seeing today. Hmm. That's what we're seeing today is destruction and disintegration.
Yeah.
And so leadership based on love, based on Christ, is going to be, it's that which unites the diversity of all the separate parts without destroying their uniqueness. Actually, things become more unique, more themselves, as they're united in love.
Yes. Amen. But I think it's important here to connect the term patriarchy with the church, because it's not strange that this view of patriarchy and hierarchy has been the common view in the world, because the world is a fallen place. It's corrupted by sin and by death. And of course, if someone, there's this saying that power corrupts, and this is the human experience since the fall of Adam and Eve. Human power corrupts. But the church is the new Eden, and Christ is the new example, or rather the oldest example of what it means to be truly human. And as you say, we need to take him as our role model and our vision of what it means to be human and what it means to be men. And that is why I usually say that the church is the hope for the creation. What we do in church is what is going to be salvific for the whole creation. And terms like these, patriarchy and hierarchy, we need to stick to them, but we need to present them in a way that is truly and genuinely Christian. We don't, I think the wrong approach is to do as perhaps some people do, to discard them and instead take modern theories from, as we alluded to earlier, Michel Foucault and people like that, and try to apply that theory to the Christian gospel. I think then you lose everything. Instead, hang on to those Christian terms and fill them with the Christian life. This, I think, is very important.
Yeah. There's an important addition to that I'd like to make. I think it helped me a lot as well.
Yeah.
And this is, again, something I have from Father Lazarus, my first first Orthodox priest I got to have a conversation with.
Yeah.
In the church, there's two hierarchies. There's a kind of earthly administrative hierarchy, which is fallen, and man based on the rule of men,
mm-hmm.
and full of problems and corruption and trouble and issues and yeah. all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then there's the hierarchy of saints, which is just as much existing in reality. It's not just an abstract hierarchy of ideas. It's actually a very present, real reality in the church. But it's men who have who've reached much further to God than what we have done. And so we have a very clear hierarchy of saints, and we deeply engrossed in their lives as well. And so the church, you know, administrative hierarchy is a necessity. We need it. But when we look to you know, how to be a man, how to live our lives, then we look to this hierarchy of saints. And that's really the source of it. Because a lot of people, they hear this, they think, well, the church is the source of hierarchy and patriarchy. And look at the church and look at what's happening between Moscow and Constantinople. It's like, yes, well, these are all very real things. And these are problems. But it's not there where we get these things from. And wherever you have positions of power and authority, then there's always going to be men who are, you know, are struggling with their own passions and their own issues, who are going to often be ending up in those positions of authority. And I'm glad I'm not the patriarch of Constantinople living in Turkey, you know, a country which does not treat Christians incredibly well all the time, and trying to handle running a church. That must be really, really difficult to do. So I'm glad it's not my job. And it's easy to stand here, you know, far away and criticize and say, oh yeah, those guys, they're so terrible and bad and evil and whatever. It's like, well, you know, they're doing the best they can. And there's a dynamic that's going on there that's far above our own understanding.
So
my job is to take the inspiration that I can use, primarily the saints, and see, well, how can I be doing, implementing, you know, living a godly life in my own tiny little circle of influence.
Let me add just one more thing to what you just said about those two hierarchies. In the liturgical context, I would add that in the liturgical context, then the earthly hierarchy is transcending the earthly and material bounds, so to speak, and imaging the heavenly hierarchy to some extent, as far as possible in our earthly context. So that's where those two meet, and we can sort of have a glance of the celestial hierarchies, to quote Saint Denis the Areopagite, when we attend liturgy. But of course, as you say, as long as we're on this side of the grave, we're going to be fallen men.
But this is why it's not important whether you like your priest or not. You know, it's like, you might have an amazing priest who just like inspires you with every single word. It's like gold dropping out of his mouth. But you might really disagree and have some fundamental, like massive issues where you think like, this is just really goes against my heart. It feels terrible. Mm. But you can still attend liturgy with that guy, and you can still be obedient to him as well. Yeah. Like this idea of obedience to a priest is a very powerful thing. I've known people who've really had massive challenges with their own parish priest, not had the opportunity to, and not even, or maybe even had the opportunity to change parish, but have decided to stay and experience the most incredible spiritual growth from submitting themselves to the specific instructions from a priest, which they disagree with. You know, we have such a, it's this very modern idea that I am the source of right and wrong, and I need to decide, and I could never do anything that goes against my, you know, if your priest isn't asking you to sin, then it can be a really, really good thing to just submit your will to him.
Yeah.
Even if you think it's like, you know better, you just submit your will to him. It's a very, very powerful thing to do. And God sees it and rewards it. We don't have to understand. We never understand the full picture to be able to submit ourselves.
No, that's great. Great advice. And if you want some examples of people submitting, you can go to the Desert Fathers and see how the young monks related to their older Gerondas or Abbas. Yeah. Paul, we're running out of time. I want to ask you one more thing before we close this interview. And what has been the response from men and women, and I think women in particular, from your work with Manifesto and with As Iron Sharpens Iron? Would you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I've almost only received positive responses. And I think for a lot of guys, there's a lot of men out there who feel like there's something wrong here. I feel like they feel like they're, you know, getting castrated almost, or losing their balls or something like that. But they're also scared to put their head up. And In the beginning, when I first started looking at this, I went into these discussions on Facebook. And I'd say there was all this kind of, like, then there was this polemic and people writing a whole lot of stuff. And so that created some, you know, unnecessary discussions. The moment I actually started doing something, instead of just talking about stuff, but doing something about this, and then you know, what I was talking about was coming from a position of experience, then I've just had so much support and encouragement and agreement from pretty much everywhere I go. Even from the most hardcore feminists, I've regularly had conversations with very, very, you know, postmodern Foucauldian kind of feminists, and they really get it. They really, everybody gets it when I have, especially on a one-on-one situation. But even in like group debates and discussions and stuff like that, I've been in like, you know, talking in front of audiences, I'll get critical questions, but I find that when I am able to, you know, put Christ first and remember to pray, then people get it. They understand what it is that we're doing here and they understand the intentions behind it. And so more and more, what I notice is that people are yearning for that masculine spirit. They miss it so much. And so in the beginning, I spent a lot of time explaining and kind of, you know, packing everything in cotton and stuff like that. And more as I'm gaining experience in this work, I can just say things a little bit more directly. And people love it and they appreciate it so much as well. I just saw a recent study on converts to Orthodoxy over the last 5 to 8 years or something like that. And the number one kind of online source of people converting to Orthodoxy, it's Jay Dyer. And there was these a couple of quotes where people are saying, like, you know, I'm almost embarrassed about that it's Jay Dyer because I see him as like, you know, this very aggressive, like, you know, kind of pushing too hard, loose cannon or something like that. But I think it is something that, you know, there is a masculine spirit in the Orthodox Church which has been preserved here. And so I think we're, you know, I would say, like, you know, let's be careful. Let's make sure that what we're saying is in love and support. You know, there's no such thing as truth without love. There's this verse, I think it's Psalm 85, which is truth and mercy have made each other, righteousness and peace have kissed, arisen from the earth, or something like that. And I think that's a core thing to have that with us as well. But I do think that as we're seeing things collapsing around us, then that, you know, that some things are going to left standing, and the Orthodox Church is going to be left standing. And I think that we in Scandinavia, almost nobody knows what the Orthodox Church is.
No.
And if more people knew it, there's at least 10% of the population that would become Orthodox straight away. They're looking for it. They're looking for the Orthodox Church. They just don't know that's what it is yet. They're looking for it. They're desperately searching for it. So I think we do need to, you know, may God raise up more voices that can be shining lights of showing this. But it needs to be done it's not just from understanding the ideas, right? We need to be living that faith and able to be able to do that for it. So, yeah.
Wonderful. Wonderful to hear. And I'm so glad to hear that when men are living this sort of God-given natural manliness in love, then people, and especially women, recognize that this is something good. This is something genuinely good. Yeah. And this is what I would like to see more of as well in our society. So, Paul, where can people find your work?
Well, on Ancient Faith Ministries, there's a podcast called As Iron Sharpens Iron. I think it's just ancientfaith.com/podcasts/iron. Of course, you can search for it. And then my own website is Manifesto with a PH, manifesto.com. And that's where we run. We have a whole lot of content that we put out there. We also have a YouTube channel where I think that's where we have, I put out a lot of stuff. So if people want to just look into it a little bit, then looking for Manifesto Conversations on Masculinity is the place to look on YouTube. And then manifesto.com, that's where all of our stuff is described and you want to look at it.
Great. It has been a real pleasure to talk to you. I wish you God's blessing and everything good for your work. And as for my Swedish-speaking listeners, jag vill tacka för att ni har lyssnat. Och som vanligt, om ni har några frågor eller funderingar så kan ni alltid skriva till mig på mikael.falthammar@gmail.com. Och jag önskar er Guds välsignelse tills vi hörs igen. Hej då.